Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Alec Maslov. Alec is the founder of Thunderhead Interglobal, a consultancy providing communication, fundraising, and business development for startups, corporates, and venture capital firms. His TEDx talk, Are We Living in a Simulation?, held at St. Petersburg State University, has had hundreds of thousands of views, and in it, Alec explores questions around simulation theory, artificial intelligence, and if, in creating a simulated reality, we end up creating a soul. He has recently founded Stellar Dream, an interactive manga with an NFT collection embedded as characters in the story. Alec, welcome to the podcast. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here with me today.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. So let's jump straight in. You presented your TEDx talk back in 2017. Fast forward to 2022 and the explosion of Web3, the metaverse, and everything that goes, in your opinion, are we any closer to living in a simulation? Like, that feels like a really evergreen TEDx talk. I'd love for you to kind of tell us about what your thoughts are now, 5 years on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was still a student back then when I gave that TEDx talk. I've learned and I've grown quite a bit since then. I'm not a physicist or a computer scientist, just an amateur researcher. But if I had a chance to go back, the first thing I would have done, I would have changed the title to Are We Living in a Metaverse? People seem to understand that better. They seem to connect with that better. And it seems to be more relevant to pop culture and just gives a better impression of what exactly I was trying to convey. So are we living in a metaverse? Are we any closer to understanding that? Well, how could we possibly tell if we are living in a metaverse? That's kind of like the quintessential question. A lot of people say that if there's no way to test it or prove it, it's just speculation and we're just in the realm of fantasy. But I mean, we create a lot of simulations and metaverses and video games ourselves. So maybe we could study those for clues about answers to this question. One thing that's common to our simulations and our metaverses, they require a lot of computing power. They require, you know, processors and different types of technology to make this world feel real. And in doing so, these programs that are built, they have to be optimized to make sure that they're using as little computing power as possible to get the best output. Because if they use too much power, it'll just be glitchy and laggy and a really terrible experience. So rendering is one of the most intensive computing processes in this whole. Rendering is one of the things that is most intensive for computing processes. And simulations have to be built to optimize for rendering. So rendering needs to be limited. And rendering is just the process of visualizing what's written in computer code. So the beautiful worlds that you see on your screen are rendered from equations. And what you see on your screen is only a small part of the total world. So everything outside of your screen is still just equations. And it's not rendered so that the least amount of computing powers can be used to give you the best experience. So what if our reality is acting in a way as if it was also optimizing or conserving power? A lot of the viewers of my TEDx talk, they commented about quantum physics. I didn't really talk about that. I'm not super qualified, but I can give a brief overview of one of the biggest kind of groundbreaking ideas in quantum physics, which is the wave-particle duality. So there are experiments like the double slit experiment that can be performed anytime, anywhere, and still return, you know, the same results or the same fundamental results. Light behaves both like a wave and a particle under different conditions. So this test revealed that light can behave like a wave when it's not being observed. And then when somebody tries to observe why it behaves that way, how it behaves that way, suddenly it behaves differently. It behaves like a particle. So without going into detail about how this experiment was conducted, could it be that this wave state is a tool that reality uses to conserve computing power. So if we're living in a metaverse, this wave-particle duality could be the way that reality renders itself for players, which we are, or could be. So, I mean, this is really a deep philosophical question. And at this point, maybe there is no way to falsify this or try to run experiments on why this happens or how it happens. But it brings up a lot of philosophical questions as well, like going back to if a tree falls and no one's around, does it make a sound?
Just as you were talking through all of that, I was kind of, I glanced outside of my window and I was sort of sat there thinking, but I don't see the world beyond the window, right? I see the world immediately outside my window, but I don't know that the road outside is still a road. Like, it may have deconstructed and depixelated and is something else altogether, right? Because we're only ever aware of our immediate surroundings and that which is within maybe, I don't know, 10 foot square around us, right? Like, or 100 foot square, maybe if you're outdoors. I think it's a super interesting question. I think, in fact, framing it from the perspective of the wave particle duality is interesting because what you're effectively saying is, you know, as a computer tries to expend as little energy as possible and as little memory as possible, right? Effective is what is happening in order for you to get the best visual experience on your screen at the time that you're looking at the screen. Maybe that's exactly what's happening outside in the real world. Like, this podcast is not, you know, the most out there of podcasts. We typically talk to kind of VCs and founders and we're talking about relatively mundane stuff, but this is the sort of stuff that I actually get quite excited about because, you know, these are the questions that whether or not, you know, whether or not you or I actually believe we are living in a metaverse or in a simulation, right? Like, we should be asking ourselves some of the questions that arise out of asking that question, right? And I think you talk about it in terms of Plato's cave and various other kind of thought experiments. And I think that's precisely it, right? These are thought experiments that we should all be going through. And I'd love to understand from your perspective, like, how the lines between real life and the metaverse are becoming blurred and where do you see that going? And equally, what are you worried about, right? Like, is it all Snoop Dogg sitting in, you know, in a mansion in the metaverse somewhere smoking a blunt? Or, you know, is there stuff that, you know, could be more insidious?
Oh, yeah, that's a really great question. I think over the last 20, 30 years, ever since kind of like this Web 1, Web 2 boom, we've had more and more digital layers placed on top of physical reality because it's useful. And the best example are smartphones. Smartphones are an extension of our brain. People, even 100 years ago, would look at us as wizards that can, you know, communicate telepathically and have instant knowledge of any subject at our fingertips, perfect memory of events with this tool that's now become like so difficult to separate ourselves from. And even now we're having digital layers, digital visual layers that are helping us in life. Like, people can model retail clothing in the mirror through their selfie cam, you know, before trying it on or buying it or what have you. You can see what it looks like on your body if you like it and then make a purchasing decision from there. There's also tools that help people get remote mechanical help. So if your car's broken down somewhere, you can connect on a Zoom call with a mechanic and they can circle on the screen what bolt you need to tighten or, you know, what part you need to replace in order to get your engine running again. There's cars that are using driving directions projected onto the windshield. And of course, Pokemon Go, people are having a lot of fun with this digital layer on top of physical reality. So it gets us to this concept. Dan Brown wrote about it in his book, Origin. So if humans are merging with technology, if there's this merging action going on where we're codependent on tech, are we becoming a new species? Is this like an evolutionary growth pattern of some sort? So that's really interesting to think about. But as far as next steps, so there's some really interesting technology out there. I'm sure people have heard of Neuralink, which is a chip embedded in your brain. I mean, at first it'll help people with cognitive disabilities and other things, but then you can imagine a world where you've got a phone embedded in your brain at all times. You're connected to the net.
Well, just before we started recording, we talked a little bit about the Matrix, right? Like, that is, you know, that is one of the things that sounds almost, I'd love to have something that just kind of injected into my brain, allowed me to learn a new skill set, you know, within seconds or minutes. I mean, the potential, if those are truly applications that can be solved, I think it could be absolutely life-changing in the same way that, exactly as you say, the mobile phone has been, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, I mean, virtual reality is still kind of taking off. It's still finding product market fit. But I think that there's a big opportunity for like VR workouts. So different types of machines that you can have a VR component, but also sort of like an exercise component where you can move your body freely on omnidirectional trampolines, for example, or machines that'll lift your body into the air and allow you to have full range of motion while you're plugged into a VR world. And also, of course, you know, this growth of the self-driving network, we can imagine a world where cars are kind of like independent things that are connected to a grid and maximize efficiency, no more traffic accidents, no more traffic jams. So there's all these kind of technologies that are coming out that are increasingly adding new digital layers to our lives. So there's even less distinction between physical reality and the metaverse. Another interesting thing to think about, I know we were talking before, you'd spoken to someone about psychedelics. So some pioneers in the VR space are exploring psychedelic experiences in the metaverse. So what is it like when we engage with psychedelic chemicals in our body, have these psychedelic experiences, but pair them with virtual digital experiences for a completely new way of being and experiencing, I guess. So that's really interesting too. And that helps to blur the lines even more, because I don't know if you've ever experienced any psychedelics before, but I've had the pleasure of doing some medical journeys and different psychedelic journeys. And it really makes you question the nature of reality, because things start to bend where they don't normally bend, you know, and images appear where they shouldn't or they wouldn't normally. And so you get this feeling like, if my visual experience of reality can change so quickly, what is the nature of it? Like, what does it actually mean?
And am I actually experiencing it in a physical world, right? Like, I guess that's the point. And to answer your question, I actually answer the same question as I recorded with Bron Rector, the founding partner of Empath Ventures. No, I haven't taken psychedelics, but I know many people who have, and I've always sort of shied away from them recreationally, but I can see the value of them in the real world in terms of therapeutics. Yeah. And in fact, you know, we talked about a company called wavepass.com, which I think has created music which allows you to deepen your experience of, you know, the therapy that you're taking, right? So again, to your point, it's that digital layer, it's an additional layer that is now allowing you to, you know, take or ingest a compound that, you know, provides a certain, you know, effect on both your body as well as your mind, but then you can deepen that or, you know, extend that or change that experience using technology, whether that's metaverse, whether that's music, whether that's something else. I think that's super, super interesting. The other thing that I think, again, I found very interesting was, you know, this issue around VR workouts. I've invested a very small check into a company called Magic.fit, which is, you know, providing AR rather than VR, but, you know, AR workouts using mirror technology to allow you to do strength training, you know, straight from your home. So doing away with the need for obviously having a personal trainer, but actually also using that AR technology to allow you to get better form, to understand, you know, what you should be doing, when you should be doing, etc. And again, you know, to your point around, you know, these VR worlds where these sort of workouts may happen. I remember during lockdown, we're recording this in sort of June 2022. So we've just been through 2 years of grueling COVID-related lockdowns in the UK, the US, and worldwide. A lot of people I know bought the Oculus, right? And were giving it to their kids, but also using it themselves and doing quite intense workouts, from what I understand, within these VR worlds, right? Like, I know a lot of people that were using it for the fencing kind of game and so on. Yeah, well, I never use it, but I guess so, right? And we're finding it was really, really physically, like it was a massive exertion, right? So as those technologies become more valuable, more useful, and not just blur the lines, but replace maybe some of those lines where, you know, previously I would never go, like I wouldn't be able to go and fence, like I don't belong to a fencing club, but maybe this is a way that I can, right? Maybe this is the next step on that journey.
Yeah, for sure. The second part of your question was like, what am I worried about in this space?
Yeah, and 100%.
Yeah, there's definitely some kind of scary things that can come out of it. First of all, there's like this uneven access to technology can widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots, the rich and the poor. If people can more easily get access to technology that makes them higher performing or, you know, more skilled at certain things, while other people don't have access to that knowledge, it's just going to create a widening gap where the people who can have access continue to accumulate wealth and knowledge and outpace their growth outpaces people who don't are not able to access that tech. Then there's a loss of real world knowledge, right? So the more we jump into this metaverse and live in these digital layers, we kind of forget more simple real world analog things. So like, what if an EMP takes out our electrical grid or, you know, our communications grid, and suddenly we don't have access to Google Maps anymore? Is anybody going to be able to find their way home? You know, like really simple questions like that. And of course, there are much more complex examples. And another thing to think about is surveillance capitalism. And the more information we upload into these digital layers about ourselves, the more corporations are going to go after them and use them for advertising. Cambridge Analytica is a big example of how that data can be used to influence political outcomes. And then the disappearance of privacy. Do we value privacy? What's the future of privacy? But also an erosion of real world social skills and EQ. So this kind of like online interaction culture where you can talk mess about whoever you want without consequences, and people behave a lot differently when they're engaging with groups inside of video games. So when they're forced into real world situations, it may be more difficult for them to find common ground and to engage with real human beings in a physical setting. So some of the things I was thinking about.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, there's a bunch of stuff there that as you were talking, I was thinking about. So, you know, you talked about the uneven access to technology and creating the haves and the have-nots, or further deepening or widening that gap between the haves and the have-nots. And I was just thinking about Altered Carbon, right? The comic book, and then, you know, the Netflix special, I think, that they've had on, or the Netflix series that they had on. And you have this concept of Methuselah's and the stacks where you're able to upload or, you know, download your personality and reuse it within skins. Like, it strikes me that we're entering that, like, not quite that phase, but like the precursor to that phase, right? Where your IRL personality can basically be supplanted by your, you know, web personality. And, you know, equally, yeah, there may be people out there who spend their entire lives within quote unquote the metaverse, even if we aren't in the metaverse, and you don't necessarily know who they are in real life, right? And I think, you know, a point about surveillance capitalism is again well taken, because that is one of the major arguments for Web3 and certainly for crypto, right? The ability to regain or retain ownership of your own data, of your own kind of personal data, so that, you know, you don't have these large corporations like Facebook or Meta, as is now Google, etc., you know, taking advantage of those, you know, let alone the government. And, you know, we're going to talk about sort of some of the themes around crypto, Web3, etc. But the other one that really resonated, you know, I'm a parent, I have two kids. One is, you know, in her just entered her 20s. The other one is an early teen. And there's already a difference between the two of them. One was born, you know, just after the millennium. The other was born literally in the year that the iPhone was released, right? So she is a digital native, has grown up with the iPhone or with phones. And, you know, that whole issue around real world skills, anxiety, et cetera, EQ, as you described it, absolutely resonates. And it's very frustrating, I think, for someone like me, I'm 43 years old, you know, to see that massive change in the ability for these young kids to be able to interact with other human beings outside of text. Like, one of the things that I still find really crazy is that, you know, you talked about it earlier, like, you know, if someone from the Middle Ages would see us, they'd think we're communicating telepathically. I mean, effectively, that's, you know, that's text messaging. My kids won't call anyone. They'll only text. Like, you know, they really don't like picking up the phone and making a phone call. And I just find a lot of this stuff really crazy. And it's going to be interesting how much deeper that goes, the more and more we kind of move into those, you know, into those worlds that aren't our world, right? And so, talking about these blurred lines, there is a huge amount of confusion and talk at cross purposes around and about Web3, metaverse, crypto, NFTs, and the creator economy. They've all been kind of lumped into one place. How would you define Web3, and what are the flaws that we need to work through to make it work? One of the things that I came across recently was a podcast, you know, Packy McCormack, who has the Not Boring newsletter and podcast, you know, was being grilled on like, what is a real life use case for kind of blockchain, Web3, et cetera. And he used the example of buying a property and having all of that on chain. And the arguments kind of made sense until they didn't, because basically you're replicating exactly what you would need to do off chain or in real life on chain, right? Like there's still a whole world of legal systems and conveyancing and so on that still needs to be done. Unless you can bring everything onto the chain, nothing should be on the chain, I guess, is the end point that was being made. So yeah, I'd love to get your take on kind of where all of this stuff sits.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, and I think it's important to go back and visit Web 1. So Web 1, static pages, focus on building the infrastructure. Oh, we can send data through pipes or through cords or through cables, right? And Web 2 is kind of like, okay, well, now we have programming languages that can build functionality, interactivity, relationships with databases, and apps that, you know, ended up becoming unicorns that made our lives a lot better. But Web 3 is kind of like adding this layer of provable ownership and immutability, right? So where is that really valuable? So one example is using a wallet as a digital passport. So having an NFT or some sort of token on your wallet that gets you access to different web pages, that gives you access to Web 2 things and maybe other Web 3 things. And to have that as kind of like your digital travel document, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, it is your passport, right? It becomes the tool which you use to navigate the online world as opposed to the real world.
Yeah, and then you have this idea of NFT collections as a digital identity. So human beings have been collecting things since the dawn of history, right? If you take your kids to the beach, they come back with a pocket full of seashells for no other reason other than we love to do it. Right. So the question is, will humans collect digital things? And if the answer is yes, the way that we're going to do that is NFTs, because the cryptographic algorithms can prove ownership, can prove authenticity, can prove provenance, can do all these really important things in the analog world that we need to take care of for collectibles like art or vehicles, you know, rare vehicles. But digital collections reveal someone's personality. What you have in your wallet, your NFT collection, reveals what you care about, reveals what's important to you. And then the other thing is, so I'm in Austin, Texas right now for Consensus, and they're doing a lot of event-based NFTs. So we'll Consensus participants will get NFTs and different tokens for being at Consensus. So you can imagine a digital wallet and a collection of event-based NFTs as a collection of memories, as a collection of events and things that you've done. So you're digitizing memories. Instead of having photos on your iPhone or iCloud, right? You have a collection of events that you've gone to on the blockchain that are permanent, right? That you can't, like, if you destroy your phone and you haven't backed up your iCloud, suddenly your whole, you know, last 6 months has not disappeared. It's on chain. You can remember the cool things that you've done and connect with other people that way. There's also a really cool concept of incentivizing community. So when people really care about something and they come together and invest in a digital kind of token for that, then it creates all sorts of incentives for people to contribute more, to be more involved and engage and create their own content, bring more members in. And the people who really care about it, about that topic, are the ones who continue to be engaged in the community. So if you stop caring about something, you can sell your token, give it to somebody else who wants it more, and the community can continue thriving that way. So there are really clear, in my opinion, use cases where crypto and NFTs are really important and contribute a lot to my idea of how the future is going to look, I guess. There are some problems. There are some big problems.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple of things just to touch on before maybe you talk about a couple of those problems, right? So you talked about seashell, like why do, you know, kids go to the beach, they collect seashells. That sparked like an interesting line of thought in my in my mind, right? We all talk about, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the value of an NFT, right? Like, you know, why did Beeple sell for whatever, how many million, tens of millions it did? Why did, you know, Jack's first tweet sell for like $4 million and is today like, you know, only worth 20 grand or whatever? And the reality is value is like whatever people want to pay for stuff, right? And if you think about seashells, seashells actually became currency because, you know, they were a scarce resource on islands, and prettiest, you know, the prettiest seashells were then used to trade. And obviously what Europeans then did was they came with prettier kind of trinkets, whether it was glass beads or whatever, and they started trading those. In fact, I read, I think again, it was on a paper about crypto, about an island nation that had a specific type of rock that was mined from another island, which was used as a currency, and it was therefore a scarce resource for them. However, when Western seafarers realized this, they could get around to these islands really, really easily. They went and mined a whole bunch of this, you know, of this particular mineral or whatever it was, and were therefore able to effectively debase the currency, right? Like just increase the supply and therefore devalue it. So I think what's really interesting is, you know, NFTs and crypto, one of the inherent kind of philosophies behind a lot of them is the scarcity, right? And that scarcity cannot be changed. And certainly with Bitcoin, we know, you know, that in theory, there will only be, you know, 21 million odd Bitcoins ever minted, and therefore, you know, the supply remains fixed, and therefore value will absolutely, you know, depend on, cannot be manipulated, I guess, by other people. So I think, like, for someone like me who doesn't, I'm not embedded in the crypto Web3 world by any stretch of the imagination. I struggle with some of the concepts behind it in terms of use cases. And I think part of the reason for that is because I think a lot of the use cases are incremental as opposed to wholesale change, right? So it is unlike, you know, we went from a place where Facebook didn't exist to Facebook existing. You suddenly had this social network, which had never existed in the past. And okay, now we have multiple social networks. Some of them work better, some don't. But we haven't had that kind of breakthrough product. And maybe this is a problem other than Bitcoin, which has gone from, you know, we have no use for crypto to, oh, wow, okay, this is the fun, like this is one fundamental place where it is absolutely kind of proven that it has worth. And the other thing that I think really resonates certainly with me, and I think this is where I'm far more, I guess, attuned and in line with where Web3 is the creator kind of economy and the community side of things. Because I think actually that, as long as it doesn't move towards tribalism, is a really kind of valuable thing, because you can discover others that you can identify with that share the same purpose, share the same sort of, you know, hopes, desires, dreams, and activities. I do wonder, from a personality perspective, you talked about like it represents your personality. Like, what does someone with a Bored Ape NFT, like, what does that say about their personality other than they had a bunch of cash and, you know, got in quick? But yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the things that I'd be interested to understand more of, though, is, yes, where are those problems? But also, are these actually, like, you know, are we talking about one thing? Are we talking about Web3, Metaverse, crypto, NFTs, all as one thing? Or actually, are they, like, are they all individual? And yes, they may have interaction, or they may, you know, they may have similar traits in some instances. But to me, you know, NFT is very distinct from, say, I don't know, like DeFi, right? For argument's sake. Although it probably sits in some way, shape, or form there as well. But yeah, I'd love to get your take on that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert in DeFi. I don't want to go outside of my competencies and say something stupid. So that's why I kind of focused on the NFT side.
I do it all the time. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that when crypto products are competing with, when crypto financial products are competing with kind of more real world traditional finance, dollar based, fiat based financial products, it's more that the community of builders and founders and companies in crypto need to have kind of the same tools, or not the same, but similar tools for managing their wealth and for growing, for investment and things like that. So it's kind of like a crypto analog to traditional finance in a way. When people are in that ecosystem, it really helps them be able to use it and live their lives. But I mean, some of the biggest problems in this are, we talked earlier about how this kind of creating this gap between the haves and the have-nots and widening the gap. So complexity as a barrier to entry, people who don't want to take the time to understand or just get too frustrated with the process is like, oh my God, what's a seed phrase? I have to write this down and lock it somewhere? Or like, you know, just a frustration and annoyance of going through the process of creating a wallet and learning a new technology from the beginning is a big barrier to entry. It's a moat. People don't want to do it. They just don't. And that continues to have an impact on the adoption of this technology. So another problem is one of my friends, he went through the process of, you know, getting into Web3. He has wallets and stuff. And he bought an NFT recently. And he said, well, what do I do now? So that's an issue with the market. It's that people don't, like we were talking about, they don't really understand the use cases. And even if they do buy an NFT, they don't understand what it's for. And looking at an NFT as a digital collectible, I think really helps address that.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I mean, like, so it's a couple of things there. I think that that whole issue around onboarding onto Web3, getting on chain, right? Like, it is a massive pain in the backside, right? Like, I mean, I remember setting up my MetaMask wallet. Like, by the time I'd set it up, I kind of like, okay, I really don't want to do anything else now.
Touch this stuff anymore.
This is it. I'm done. But I mean, you know, on Twitter, I think one of the sagest piece of advice that was kind of being given by lots of people is like, if you're going to buy an NFT, buy it because you want to buy it, right? Don't buy it because you think you're going to do something with it or it has utility or whatever. Like, if you're buying it, exactly as you say, it's a digital collectible, buy it because you love it, buy it because you buy into, you know, the beauty of the artwork or the nature of the community or whatever it is. Don't buy it because you think, okay, well, how am I going to trade this up or trade this down or whatever? You should want to keep it, right? It should be something that you would be happy to kind of take out of your wallet, as it were, and look at on a regular basis rather than something that you're planning to do something with.
I mean, the thing is, like, the markets for collectible physical analog goods that are collectibles is very sophisticated. Like, Sotheby's and major auction houses are arranging, you know, huge transactions. So I'm not trying to discourage people from going down the route of looking at NFTs as an investment, but it's really sophisticated. You have to treat it as something that you need to research. You need to understand the trends. You need to understand where value is moving, why it's moving there, and really take it seriously if you want to be an investor in that space and use collectibles as a tool to build wealth. The other two problems I was going to mention, I know I'm kind of running short on time, but cross-chain transactions. So carrying information from one technology to another in the blockchain space, and siloed metaverse experiences. So it's really hard to, just like chains, transferring information between different blockchains, transferring items and collectibles between one metaverse experience to another metaverse experience is really not easy right now and may never be easy for commercial reasons. So yeah, that's just things to think about.
Yeah, the siloed experiences strikes me as being one of the big problems that, if it isn't solved, makes it less and less accessible, right? Because the whole point, I guess, around Web3 is that it is ubiquitous. It is for the people. It is not gatekeeper. There are no gatekeepers, rather. You don't have like behemoth Web2 type businesses, again, like Facebook, Meta, Google, Apple, et cetera, controlling all this stuff. But if you can't easily move from chain to chain, or, you know, metaverse to metaverse, it suggests that there has to be a one metaverse takes all kind of situation. And actually, I was reading, I think I mentioned to you, I was reading Snow Crash, which I can't believe I hadn't read it before. It's a great, like, I mean, irrespective of the way it describes the metaverse and the topics that it covers, I think it's just an absolutely wonderful, wonderful piece of fiction. Or is it? But I think, you know, in Snow Crash, it talks very much about like there being one metaverse. It doesn't talk about multiple metaverses, right? You all go in, like, you may have land in that metaverse. You may have different areas within the metaverse, but it is just one metaverse. And actually, I think this is a good kind of segue into kind of the stuff that you're up to, right? So I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about Stellar Dream, Sanctuary Citizens, and the God Level collection of NFTs. What questions do you think, you know, this is all going to force us to challenge ourselves with, and where do you see it kind of going?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate being able to talk about it. We're building an interactive manga, which is a Japanese style comic book with an embedded NFT character collection that's drawn into the story. So we are experimenting with a change in consumer behavior. We want to explore different styles of ownership where fans can literally own a character in their favorite story. So how do fans interact with IP now? You can buy a comic book, you can buy a video game, you can have the experience of consuming it and then like put it on a shelf or, you know, wrap it in a mint container. But what if fans can actually own a character, change that character's appearance, and that appearance will be reflected in future editions? right? And so you create a really engaged community and people are invested in the story. So right now we're building a pilot project for this. We'll be launching our first proof of concept manga in July, which is going to be like a one-page comic book with some of these characters drawn in to the manga. We want to make them clickable. And to the right-hand side of the manga, there will be a space where information from OpenSea will feed into it. So the name of the piece, the JPEG that represents the NFT, the owner, the transactions, the volume, and even the ability to bid on that character directly from the comic book. So that's kind of what we're building. The God Level Collection is our like proof of concept collection built on Ethereum. And essentially it's the face of the buyer drawn onto the body of a god or a goddess in our story. And we're working with investors, influencers, different NFT collections. We can draw, you know, loved ones that have passed. So all sorts of interesting ways that we're experimenting on how to build out this collection, how to integrate it into a comic book, and how to make the experience interactive to change consumer behavior about how fans interact with their favorite stories.
So this is crazy, right? So I grew up loving fiction, reading. I loved comic books, not manga, but I loved kind of just comic books in general. I wasn't like a fan of DC and, you know, Marvel in the sense that I wasn't out there looking at those. I had friends who were collecting, you know, I think one of my friends collected DC comics and my daughters certainly love Marvel. But my point is, this actually blows my mind because this is akin to you being able to participate in your favorite soap opera or your favorite, you know, movie or, you know, or whatever it is, right? And here you get the opportunity to actually live within the narrative arc of the story, right? And you may be able to do that across multiple stories, right? And I've had the privilege of reading, and I think you've got your first few kind of chapters on Medium, right? And I've read through and it's a really engaging story. So, you know, when we talked about earlier, like what are the actual use cases? To me, this is an actual use case, right? Because it goes beyond just buying a thing for the sake of buying the thing. Here, you actually, it has utility. It is an esoteric utility, right? It isn't like, okay, I can go and, you know, I can go and exchange it for a box of cereal. Maybe I can in the future, I don't know. But at the moment, it's not I can exchange it for a box of cereal. But what I can do with it is participate in the story and hopefully maybe influence that story, right? And then you get into the whole community aspect. And then, you know, I think about, you know, the kind of Johnny and the World, I can't even remember what they're called now, but these books where you could choose your own
adventure.
Yeah. Right, choose your own adventure. And you could see that kind of forking of stories and you can participate in the story. I actually personally think that that's a really compelling use case, right? And let's face it, there are lots of people who consume this sort of fiction, this sort of, you know, this sort of medium. And all you're doing is now transporting that from, you know, paper manga comics to like online manga comics to like or to cartoons or whatever, and then to like online. And now this goes one step further. It allows you to interact in the story. And presumably you'll also be creating a metaverse within the story, right? Or as in that where characters can go and kind of hang out that reflects the kind of the world of the story, right?
Yeah. So what's interesting about our project is that we built a 3D model for a fantasy city. It's deep underground. The ceiling is made of crystal and there's giant mushrooms and insects and stuff. And it's, you know, this crazy world. But the reason we did that is because we want to speed up the production of the manga itself once we're ready to roll. The way we do that is you can change the camera angle using a software called Clip Studio. You can change the camera angle within this 3D model. Click to take a photo and that'll get converted to comic form. So you don't have to redraw the city by hand every time you want to create a new frame. But then this also creates the possibility to create digital avatars of the NFT collection, populate this 3D model. First of all, put it on a game engine and then populate this 3D model with characters so that people can go about engaging in digital commerce. And we can just select camera angles, click a snapshot, and have these characters automatically be populated inside of a comic book down the road so that what you do in this metaverse will actually be reflected in a permanent history of a comic book. And down the road, we're thinking like having, you know, competitions within the story, like entrance exam to be a soldier in this world, right? And having NFT holders participate in this gamified thing, documenting it in comic book form, And then allowing the winner to become like a secondary support character that has a bigger role in the story, for example. So, I mean, that's just one example of some of the thought experiments we're playing around with to make it more engaging and awesome.
And I think this is maybe where some of us that are a little bit kind of suited and booted and maybe the doom and gloomers around Web3 and so on, like actually what it is exactly as you said, it's like a thought experiment about it's the world of what if, right? Because you aren't constrained by anything realistically, right? Other than the power of your imagination, which I think is the thing that we probably lack most in today's world. Like I think one of the most sad thing is that the overpromotion of STEM is actually stopping us from promoting the one thing that allows STEM to happen, which is creativity, right? Like, I mean, without creativity, STEM is valueless, and actually STEM over time will be further and further like digitized away, as in, you know, computers will be coding for us. We won't be writing the code. We'll just be deciding what needs to be written in the sense that we'll be creating the problems or, you know, creating the questions that we're asking these technologies to solve. So I think there is a massive, massive opportunity to explore those things, of course. And as you said, like it comes down to, you know, who you get to participate, how they can participate, how you can encourage more and more people to kind of join that sort of community and think about it. And, you know, you may end up in directions that you never actually even thought of, right? So I think that's actually a really interesting and compelling use case for NFTs and for Web3 in general. Just as we kind of round off, like this podcast is all about taking the plunge, especially when it comes to kind of backing yourself. There's been a huge cooling off sentiment towards Web3 of late, right? And I mean, like to be blunt, it's not just Web3, it's across kind of venture and technology in general. But maybe it's also because there was a lot of hubris in the projects that were being launched and certainly a fair share of kind of fraud as well, right? But equally, we're seeing massive firms like Andreessen Horowitz doubling down on the sector. So what advice would you give to creators who want to launch in Web3 today? What is the thing that they need to think about most and how do they get themselves going?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's really important to note that it's not just Web3, that it's the entire world economy is reorganizing right now. There's some conflicts and different things going on. The role of the dollar is being questioned. Oil as a power engine for the global economy is being questioned. And trade flows, commodity flows, currency flows, all of that stuff is right now under big question marks about how it's going to look even in the next few years. So, of course, Web3 is facing its own questions, right? And the future of Web3 is kind of also hanging in this big global uncertainty. But even still, even in bear markets, the good projects are going to continue to get funding. They're going to continue to get traction. They're going to continue to get adoption. And the question is, do people think crypto is here to stay? Is crypto going to be around for the long term? If yes, then this market's going to rebound and that there's going to be new types of value that are created. About A16Z's $4.5 billion fund that they just raised back in May. The bear market is a great opportunity to buy good assets at a discount. That's how good investors have always capitalized on market downturns. When the sentiment is really scary for retail investors and that they don't want to participate in the market, the really good assets, their values start to go down so you can buy them cheaper. And like I said, good projects will always get traction, even in downturns. And about bad projects and fraud, you always see that in meltups. So the dot-com boom, for example, right? Every single web address or company with a dot-com in its name got absurd amounts of funding. It's just like symptomatic of certain market cycles, in my opinion, where you have easy money that's flowing. You have this, you know, what did Greenspan call it? Irrational exuberance, where people are just overly confident for no logically good reason. And fraudsters take advantage of that kind of sentiment. It's human nature, unfortunately. My advice to someone who wants to get into Web3, who wants to launch an NFT project, who wants to do some cool stuff in this space. So first of all, study thoroughly. If you want to launch your own collection, study successful collections like the Bored Apes. Study what they did with the traits and rarities of their collection. Study their roadmap, who they talked to and who they had to work with first to become a success. And study the technology, study the trends in the market. So just like Web2 led to unicorns, and Web3, there's already unicorns in the Web3 space. There are going to be more Web3 unicorns. If I believe crypto is here to stay. I believe we will use crypto in all sorts of applications for digital identity, for digital personality, for things that we talked about earlier. So there will be opportunities. And just like in traditional entrepreneurship or startup or founding your own company, part of it is about predicting a change in consumer behavior. How will consumers interact with brands? How will consumers interact with food? How will consumers have babies in the future? And predicting changes that make their people's lives easier or that make it more convenient is a surefire way to find an idea that can make you a lot of money or, you know, change the world or both at the same time. Then, of course, if you want to get in the NFT collection, it's really important to focus on the art piece of it and the social engagement piece. So having a strategy to be at the forefront of art and to create a way to engage with the community is really important. And of course, it also goes back to studying existing collections, how they're successful, and the role that social plays in that. So another important thing is to take a deep dive into new sources that are specific to the industry that you want to do. Like if you want to launch an NFT collection, start reading NFT news every day. If you want to launch an infrastructure project, start picking new sources that are talking about protocols and infrastructures and new technology in that space. Attend conferences, network your ass off. And when you finally think that you've come up with something interesting that where you see value in it, then it's time to create a roadmap and take baby steps to get there, slowly but surely building things that lead up to an MVP or some kind of pilot project that shows this change in consumer behavior that you're hoping to capitalize on. Identify everything that you need to build this MVP. Find the gaps in your own skill sets. Get co-founders that can handle the parts that you can't. Start executing on your roadmap and build an MVP and go out there and show the world what you're doing. If it really is valuable, if it really is something that people love, then you'll get investors to back it. You'll get a community that's excited about it. And you'll start, you know, you'll create something that will change the world. If not, go back to square one and analyze your basic assumptions.
Amazing. I mean, I think that's incredibly good advice, irrespective of kind of whether it's Web3, Web2, or anything else. But certainly for Web3, which is, you know, changing so quickly, so rapidly, almost on a daily basis, I think it's really important to be up with exactly what's happening in the ecosystem at this moment in time and how it's changing and how it's moving forward. I think we'll list some of those, you know, news sites like NFT News on the website as well, because I think, you know, it is really difficult, I think, for anyone who doesn't have a strong kind of understanding or doesn't have strong relationships within the ecosystem to understand how to get in. And I think a lot of venture in general, Web3 as well, you know, tends to center around small communities of insiders. And it is about becoming, you know, one of those insiders in order to help yourself kind of launch from there. But I think that's absolutely amazing advice. Look, Alec, it's been absolutely amazing speaking with you today. I've really enjoyed our conversation. For our listeners, where can they find you online? Are you on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to find you on the web or Web3 for that matter?
Yeah. So the website for our project is stellar-dream.com. And actually, we're going to be launching a pilot project, a website redesign in July. So that URL may change to stellardreamers.com. We are at stellardreamNFT on Twitter and Instagram. And you can find our Discord through our website.
Amazing. Alec, it's been absolutely amazing having you here with me today. Thank you so much. I couldn't have asked for more.
It was an absolute pleasure, man. I had a lot of fun. I can't wait to hear it.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.